Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me here, and thank you those who attended our workshop in the morning. You have a great town, great city, great university, wonderful faculty and students. So thank you. And I'll be talking today about something that we call ISLE. People look at this abbreviation and say, ISLE, like an island, right? Investigative Science Learning Environment. I could also change the title of my talk to this one. You know, rethinking the role that our students play when they learn physics. So, are they observers and listeners, or they're active participants? And before we talk about physics, I want to ask you a question, and I want you to think about the answer without saying anything. When people learn something, where does this learning actually happen? You can say it happens in the classroom, or it happens in the world. That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking you about the learning person. Where does this learning happen? A little bit of a help. Right? It happens actually in the brain, not just in the brain, in the body of the learner. Now we know that you cannot separate your brain and the brain activity from everything else that happens in your body. But if we're not very precise, we can say that learning is when your existing networks fire, extend, and change. Right? So, and this, you'll say, duh, of course I know it. Right? Everybody knows it. But knowing it and applying it to what you're doing in the classroom are two completely different things. Because think about it, learning happens when a learner does something inside her or his brain. It is his brain that needs to change. So when we think then about learning as sitting and observing somebody sharing the wealth of his or her brain's neural connections, it cannot possibly lead to learning. And now we know a little more about how brain works. If you have a chance to get a book by James Zhao, The Art of Changing the Brain, then he, in relatively accessible language, he is a biologist, not an educator at all. He's a professor of biology. He describes how our brain comes to learn anything. And any kind of learning starts with the physical experience. It has to be a sensory experience, and that's what he calls concrete experience. We hear a new word. We start thinking, you know, that's a new word that I heard. We need to realize it's a new word, right? And then we start thinking, what can it possibly mean? And once we come up with what it can possibly mean, we are repeating it, we're saying it out loud. That's how we learn languages. We walk into a room and we see a person and look at him and say, Andrew? Well, I know I'm meeting Andrew, right? I observe a person, looks like a relatively young man, so I form a hypothesis, this is Andrew, right? And I am doing active testing when I say, Andrew, right? That is the active testing process. And it all happens in our brain in a fraction of a second. Now we know a little more about how people learn. Not that they need to engage their brains, which is kind of obvious, but how they need to engage their brains, how they engage their brains. But we also know what conditions are needed. It turns out that learning is a social process, that it happens when people share something together, when they discuss it. It is true for all our physics laboratories, right? It's very hard to learn to work on your own and learn anything new. So as physicists, we're social creatures, despite all the jokes that go around about it. And so for the students to learn, they need to be able to learn with somebody. So that's another, I would say, field of research that helps us understand what conditions are needed for people to learn. But there's the third field that is very, very important, and it's called discipline-based education research, or DBER. Discipline-based education research is research on how people learn their discipline that happens in the math departments, biology departments, chemistry departments, physics departments, not in the schools of education. And this discipline-based education research, I would say physics is probably a pioneer in this, or at least a very important player. It has some robust findings that for now do not need any more testing, that there's enough evidence for me to put them on the slide. And the first slide is that traditional teaching, traditional means when I'm standing here telling you things and you listen to me, and then you watch somebody solve problems on the board, and then you go to a lab and you follow very good instructions on what buttons to push, this instruction leads to very little learning, and we can measure this learning using special tests. And if I were not afraid to be too provocative, I would say that these learning gains are almost non-existent. These learning gains, sadly enough, are independent of the experience, charisma, or interest or motivation of the instructor. And again, this has been found again and again. We don't need to look for more. We always need to look for more evidence, but we have enough. Reform instruction, when students work in groups, they solve problems, they argue with each other, they're actively engaged. When they're active participants, not passive observers, produces learning gains, sometimes not so great, but sometimes very good. But they're always slightly better than very tiny gains in traditional instruction. So these are empirical findings. And if I did not show you the other two slides, we would say, well, this is what we know from experimentation. Now, how do we explain it? Well, it turns out that what we know about the brain and what we know from cognitive research actually explains these findings very, very well. If people are not engaging their brains actively, they cannot possibly learn. And if they're not working with other people, they cannot possibly learn. So if we satisfy these two conditions, then they have a chance to learn. It doesn't mean they will, right? They have a chance, and that's what we know from the studies on reformed instruction. They might learn, not necessarily will learn for sure, but in the traditional way, they almost do not have any chance to learn. And you would say, well, what is she talking about? I learned. Each one of you learned because you were not sitting passively during these lectures, because for some mysterious, magical reason, you knew how to activate your brain, how to argue with the professor, maybe not with words, but with something else, how to find your buddies to work with and work on the problems. And those who didn't, these are the ones who dropped out. These are the ones who are not sitting here. These are the ones who did not become professional physicists. And this is the majority. If I'm way too provocative, just divide me a little bit, okay? But it's not it. Because you can engage people in learning if you know how people learn, and they will learn anything. If you know how people learn, you create the conditions, they will learn whatever you want them to learn. The question is, what is it that you want them to learn, right? That is another question, and it's a huge question that we do not try to have not been trying to answer probably in 100 years. In 2014, in the United States, came out a document, I would say maybe even it was the end of 2013, just called Next Generation Science Standards. It is a document that says what ideally students should be able to do when they finish grade 12. And Next Generation Science Standards talk about three-dimensional learning. There's some disciplinary core ideas we want students to learn, and there's some other two things that we want them to learn. And one of those things is science practices. We want our students to be engaged in, and we're going to assess them on, how well they can practice these things. What are those things that they need to practice? The standards outline them very specifically, and students have to practice them from kindergarten to grade 12. So I'll put these practices here. That's kind of hard to do if you're watching somebody solving a problem for you, right? The same, that's impossible to do if somebody's doing it for you. If you're doing a cookbook lab, you cannot do that. If the directions for analyzing and interpreting data are given, you're not doing it on your own. You can probably do this if somebody models it to you, but you cannot do that, right? And you definitely cannot do this. So these practices can only be enacted if students are actively engaged in their learning and if they are constructing their own knowledge as opposed to somebody feeding it to them. I looked at Canadian situation, and what I found in the province of Ontario, these are the goals of science education. And you can see it right here, right? You want your students in K-12 to think like physicists, right? You want them to develop the habits of mind of practicing scientists. So these are all the same goals, right? Very similar. You also have an amazing thing here. It's called Smarter Science. Have you heard about it? The Smarter Science is a group. It's a framework for teaching and learning science in grades 1 to 12. When students are engaged in these activities that they propose, they are investigative problem solving, enabled by a teacher who helps them address challenges. As they learn and think and act like scientists, they become independent learners. So that's what is happening in K-12 education in Canada. And similar things are happening in the U.S. And similar things are happening in Europe. So why is the focus of science education changing? And I have a few ideas about it. And the major reason is the world is changing. So what is changing in the world that makes us really rethink what we think about the goals of education? First one is that information is available, right? So factual information is not needed to be communicated in class anymore. Newton's second law, you go Google it, you'll get a million YouTube videos and other things, right? So factual information is not the goal of education anymore. But students, our students are growing up in the world where they collaborate and communicate 24 hours a day. This is their strengths that they did not have before. They collaborate playing computer games, and they solve problems through these computer games that scientists could not solve. Are we capitalizing on their skills, on their abilities that they all have much better than we? I mean people of my age, not some of you sitting here, obviously. And finally, is the changes in the workplace. Think about the workplace of the 19th century. If you think about a person who is busy at work, this person is probably plowing the field because most of people were engaged in agriculture. If you think about the workplace of the 20th century, your image would be a person standing at the conveyor belt because most of the population was engaged in manufacturing, right? So when you're standing in the conveyor belt, you better follow directions very well. So that's why cookbook labs were so important. If you don't know how to follow directions, you will lose your arm or leg or something else, right? But now, as you know, in the 21st century, everything at the conveyors are done by robots. Most of the manufacturing process is done by robots. So people who will succeed in the 21st century are not the people who can follow directions or who know a lot of factual information. If you looked at the World Economics Forum, these are the skills that are top 10 skills by employers in 2015. 15, complex problem solving, coordinating with others, people management. This is what will get you promoted now. Look at 2020. Complex problem solving, critical thinking, and creativity. So these are the things that our students need to be successful. And doing science as a scientist, it was developed these skills naturally, so that's why the focus of science education is changing, because you know, believe it or not, but economy and success in economical world drives everything that we do. That's just a Marxist statement. Next generation science standards also have a sentence that I love. And honestly, of course I care about workplace, but I much more care about this. Is I'm a physics teacher. I want to teach physics as a science. I do not want to teach some other discipline. And a part of physics is how physics is done, not just the final outcome. So when we are teaching just the final outcome of physics, we misrepresent it because we're teaching our students some other field of inquiry, not the physics we love. So what does it all mean for us? Very simple. We just need to change. We need to change the way we think about the goals of student learning. It's not about learning physics as a done deal anymore. That won't get them very far. It's about our role in learning. Are we presenting this physics to them, or are we doing something else? And how to play it best. There are tons of research and curriculum materials based on research developed that we can use. Are we using them? But here, I'm not going to tell you about active learning at all. Because you know about clickers, you know just-in-time teaching. These are the methods that allow your students to learn better the content that you want them to learn anyway, or the content that you have been teaching for years. The goal of my talk is to get you to think how to change what we are focusing on when students are learning. And then, of course, we can use all active methods, but again, I am focusing on what is it we want our students to learn. And I'm going to give you an example of what it looks like. Okay? So, have you ever shined a laser pointer at a mirror? Raise your hands. Have you ever shined a green laser pointer at a mirror? Good. Did you notice anything, something, when you shined, other than the beam reflects? Did you notice what happens when you shine a laser pointer at a mirror? And amazing things happen. So that's the setup. See, the mirror is flat. There's a laser pointer right there, right? Shining on the mirror. We see this little thing here. That's the reflection. If we look close, wow, you're anticipating. That's what happens. It's not just one dot. It's a series of dots, right? Really cool. So let's say you happen to observe it, right? What do you do next as a physicist? Huh? Oh, why would you play around with the laser? Why would you want a pattern change? Because deep inside, you have a question, right? And what is this question when you started moving the laser and the mirror and everything else and other things that you can do? What's the question? What's going on here, right? Why do we have this pattern, right? I can just imagine you going home with a laser in your pocket and shining it in a mirror to see what happens, right? So that's what we do. We start wondering why it happens. So what do? Then when we start turning the laser in the mirror, we actually, before we do this, deep in our heads, or maybe not so deep, we did some operations, right? And if we know what operations we did, we could teach them. So I'm trying to unpack what is happening in your head, right? So what is happening? So you ask this question, how does it happen, and what do you do next in your head? Imagine you cannot touch anything. Yeah, you start creating a model, right? Can it be because of this or because of that? So what do you think? I want you to turn to your neighbor for 10 seconds and share what it could be that creates this pattern. So what's the mechanism behind? Come on.
Thank you.
You got the point, right? It's about you talking to other people to come up with as many ideas as possible. Then you put them in a grant and say, we have this, this, and that explanation, and we need to figure out which one is correct. This is how we do physics, right? So we asked undergraduate physics majors. They came up with these ideas. Well, it's interference, some kind of an interference. Maybe there's some structure inside, like Bragg diffraction thing. These are interference-based models. Maybe there's some layers inside the mirror, and light was reflecting from different layers. It was reflecting from like mirror-type layers, specular reflection, or maybe it was no layers, and it's specular and diffuse reflection. And that's how we see the dots. And this would be reflection-based models, right? So now we have all these models. What do? We write another grant, right? To get more money. To do what? Test them, right? To run experiments to test them. And I put it here. I didn't know you would say it, but we're all physicists, right? So we think the same. And what we want is our students to think the same. In terms of the process, we'll come up with different ideas, but we will approach these ideas in the same systematic way. So what does it mean to test something? To test something means to accept it temporarily as correct, even if you don't like it. Design an experiment whose outcome you can predict using this idea. Make an experiment, compare the outcome to the prediction, and see if they match. Well, of course, you understand that there are assumptions involved, and assumptions is what you don't know you're assuming until they kill your experiment. But that's a different story. It's still a part of the process. So, what experiment can we conduct whose outcome we can predict using every model that we constructed? Students come up very quickly with this one experiment that will test all of the models. They say, well, take a front-plated mirror, right? All of the experiments involved some kind of a structure. Above the shiny metal, right? So if you take a front-plated mirror, then there should be no pattern, right? And that's exactly what happens. Wow. So, of course, we're laughing because the match does not give us much, right? It's the mismatch that we're looking forward to because it gives us more confidence that something is wrong than something is wrong, right? Because all of them cannot be right simultaneously, right? So, testing experiment that matches, whose outcome matches the prediction does not prove. It just fails to disprove, right? So, that's another experiment that we could do, right? And if it is an interference-based explanation, then the distance between the dots should change, right? And if it is a reflection-based explanation, the distance should not change. These are actually the experiments that my undergraduate TAs suggested when I was doing the training. So we had two lasers, red and green, and that's what we did. And when they're shining at the same angle, that's what happens, right? So what does it tell us? Possibly, the interference-based models are not so great. But one experiment is still not enough. Let's think of something else. What else could we do to test the interference models and the reflection-based models? Huh? Thicken the glass. Absolutely. Yep. So now we know if we take a thinner mirror or a thicker mirror, the interference pattern will change. And if you take a thinner mirror, then the pattern should get wider and wider. And if it is a reflection-based models, the dots should get closer, right? And of course, we need some ray diagrams to reason to it, but I'm skipping that part for you because I know you understand. So, and this is what happens. So if you take a thick mirror and thinner, the dots get closer. So now, how do we feel about the interference-based models? Probably not so good, right? But we still have the question, is it layers and specular reflection, Or it is no layers, just one shiny layer at the bottom of the glass and specular and diffuse reflection. And I have an experiment that is photographed here. But again, my students recently came up with a better experiment that I don't have a photo of. I'll tell you. So the experiment that you can do is look at the reflection on the side, and then you can actually predict that in the layer model, the brightest spot would be the lowest, because that would be the reflection from the shiny layer of the mirror, not this other layer, assuming it's the shiniest. In the specular and diffuse reflection model, it's the second from the top that should be the brightest, because this is the reflection from the mirror itself, right? And here is the picture. So you can see that the second is the brightest. But we did even better, because instead of the mirror, we just took a thick piece of glass. To do all this, you don't need a mirror. You can just take glass of multiple thicknesses, and you will see that there are, the reflection is from the top and the bottom, and you can see this diffuse spot. So it is a better one. But at the end, you are left with this model, and then you can study it as much as you want deeper. So what is it that we did or could have done? And of course, when the students do it, they work in groups, coming up with explanations, designing experiments, carrying experiments, discussing their conclusions. Is that first we observed something, and we came up, and we agreed on what we saw, right? I asked you, you know, if you're seeing these dots. And often, we forget to ask the students if they see what we see. So that's an important thing. We came up with several explanations, and we detailed them using the ray diagrams, right? If we just talked about them, it would be less specific than if we could draw a picture. That's why it's important to draw a picture or a ray diagram or a force diagram, right? And we ruled them out one by one with new experiments, and we are left with the one that was not ruled out. Yes? Well, you don't predict, you anticipate. You anticipate based on several things. One thing is that everything that they do, if they're learning conventional concepts that we want them to learn, has been probably come up with in the history of physics. So knowing the history of physics helps. And secondly, when they are coming up with different ideas, you record them and you use them. But if you are not ready to test some of the ideas, then you say, we're going to test it tomorrow. Right. But yes, knowing what they will come up with is very important. So this is basically it. That's what investigative science learning environment is. It is a process through which students can construct knowledge similar to the way we construct knowledge as physicists, working together, experimentalists and theorists. So we observe something usually when doing something else and pay attention. And if you take the history of physics, lots of these observations were accidental when other people saw, didn't pay attention, or when somebody saw and said, I don't have time to investigate it. That's the example of photoelectric effect that Hertz observed and said, I don't have time to go into that. I'm testing some other ideas by Maxwell, right? Identified patterns and came up with possible explanations. These explanations, this word is a simplification of what's happening. Can be causal explanation, mechanistic explanation, can be quantitative relationships. So, you know, to figure out, you need to figure out what physical quantities are involved. So this is complicated, but basically we can lump it all with some thinking, right? So we get the data, we start thinking about it. After we thought about it, we need to test our thinking. And we test by designing experiments. We design experiments whose outcome we can predict. And then we compare the outcome to the prediction, and we're happy when it is a no, they do not match, because we know what to do. We either check assumptions, or we conduct more experiments and get more data, or we say, well, maybe we can come up with a new explanation. When it's a yes, when it's a match, we need to do more testing experiments, and you really don't know when to stop, maybe when the money runs out. But eventually, when you do stop, you start applying what you could not rule out. You build a bridge, you send a satellite in space, you do all these things that we do based on the things that we tried to rule out, and we couldn't. For example, Newton's law of universal gravitation, you know, how many times people tried to rule it out and they failed, and now we use it for practical purposes. So these are the students engaged in this process. You can see they're collecting data, they're discussing it, and they're working the way we are, but there's more to it. If you go back to the brain cycle, remember how the brain cycle goes? Sensory information, reflective observation, hypothetical thinking, testing, right? This is where the sensory information comes in. These are your observation experiments come in the back of your brain. You identify patterns and start thinking about what is it that you're seeing, and you're coming up with different hypotheses, right? And then you actively test them by engaging a special motor function. So it turns out that this process that our brain engages in naturally is very similar to the process that physicists engage in naturally when they come up with new physics, and that is the approach that we want our students to experience when they're learning physics. So I'll show you a quick example that we just did in the workshop that happened today. So let's say you have the students who never saw a small LED. They saw big light bulbs, LEDs, but they're all frosted. You can't see what's inside, right? And they don't know what the difference is. They just know they're more expensive and they take less energy. So can they figure out the difference between a light bulb and an LED? If they have done circuits, we can give them these two elements and ask them to design experiments to get the light bulb to light and the LED to light. They have two batteries, a few wires, and that's it. And what they do is this. They have the light bulbs, and they see you can light it with one battery or two batteries, no matter how the orientation works. For the LED, only two batteries work, only in a certain orientation. So that's what they find. So then they need to describe the patterns, right? And they can organize them in any way they want. And then they need to devise several causal explanations for the observed patterns. I put two explanations there that the students commonly come up with. These are causal explanations. They don't know about p-n junctions. They've never learned about semiconductors. But they have the ideas why it works this way. One, that the LED allows current to go in both directions, but it only lights when the current is in one direction. And the other idea that the LED is kind of an open door or a switch. It only allows current to pass in one direction, and that's when it lights, but the voltage need to exceed some threshold voltage. So you have two explanations. That's exactly what we just did with the mirror experiments. What do? With them? We test them. So they do testing experiments. Now you see that all experiments that they do, they split into three big categories. Observation experiments, when they don't expect things. Testing experiments, when they expect things. So, but they don't go and do experiments to see what happens. That is not what a testing experiment is, because nobody would give you money. NSA wouldn't give you money to go and see what happens, right? You say, we expect this to happen. That's why we need this piece of equipment to see this, right? So you have to have very careful predictions. In education, we need to give predictions, you know, with a significance, you know, what effect we expect to get, right, and the p-value. So they need to use the explanations and predictions, right? They need to write them, but they cannot do the experiments. So we really teach them the difference between an explanation and a prediction. Then perform the experiment and make a judgment, right? So what experiments do they do? Well, the first one is easy. If they say, well, let's take an ammeter, and then there will be no current, no glow, or when there is current, there will be glow if we have two batteries, and then it's good. They reject one, and they don't reject the other. But some of them do a different experiment. Instead of an ammeter, as you guys did today, they take a light bulb, right? And then an interesting thing happens. The LED in one orientation lights up, but the bulb doesn't. Wow, we just have a new observational experiment for a light bulb. We know there's current, but the bulb does not light up, and it's a puzzle. What happens? We did not experience this before because we know we put a light bulb across any battery, it lights, right? So we come up with new hypotheses, and we start testing them, and one of them is the light bulb needs more current than the LED, so if we put more batteries, it will light. So what students learned here? They learned a lot, and it only took about 20 minutes. They learned the difference between an LED and a bulb. They learned the main properties and unexpected properties of a bulb, and they learned all this. So how much more did they learn? And they did it exactly the way we're doing. So what is ion? It's not a curriculum. I don't want you to think about a curriculum, because once you start thinking about it as a curriculum, you say, it's not for my course. That's for an introductory course. That's for babies. Ion is a philosophy. It's a philosophical approach of how you think of people learning and teaching physics. For the instructor, it means thinking not how I will explain something or what demos I will show, but what will my students do to come up with something. For the students, is not my ideas right or wrong, but how can I test them? Because that's what is the most important skill of a physicist. We're not afraid of new ideas. The students are, because they might be wrong. We are not, because we know what to do about them, right? So the most important thing in IELTS is the students know where the knowledge comes from. And in many reformed approaches, knowledge comes still from authority. They read a textbook before class, they do just-in-time teaching by reading the textbook, they answer clicker questions, but the knowledge comes from authority. In this approach, the knowledge comes from experimentation, reasoning, testing your ideas, failing, and succeeding. So it is different. Two things are very different. Students do not make predictions before the observational experiments, and they do not read the book before they come to class. If in class happens what we do, but you're sitting thinking, well, it takes a long time. How can I possibly cover everything? You don't have to. Because if the students know how to think, you don't need to do all this in class. You can do some, and some you can assign. Then they read the book, but they read the book with different eyes. They ask themselves, are they describing observational experiments? Are they describing reasoning? Are they describing testing experiments? So they read the book as experts do, not as the source of knowledge that is not questionable. That's how the students read the book now. That is what the book says, so it must be true, right? And that is the most controversial statement, that this philosophy can be applied to any course. You can use IELTS in a first grade classroom. You can use it in an advanced graduate course in physics. But the difference is how and what the students will learn. Where will this knowledge come to them? So if you think about IELTS, you think about it as having three pillars on which the whole philosophy rests. Ways of reasoning that we want the students to learn, tools for reasoning, and practicing this reasoning in authentic contexts. So authentic context means like real life, right? So what are the forms of reasoning students learn? Inductive, when they infer patterns. Analogical, when they come up with explanations, because all our explanations are more or less analogical. And hypothetical deductive, when they test the ideas. Multiple representations, the bridge between words and mathematics, is crucial. We only use a little bit of ray diagrams, but IELTS philosophy is full of different ways of how to use representations to bridge words and mathematics. And scientific habits of mind that they develop when they design their own experiments in labs. And again, this is what the participants of the workshop experienced today. And this is a very important part of IELTS, but it's not all of it. Some people tell me, oh, you created IELTS, this lab curriculum. It's not a curriculum, it's not a lab curriculum. But you can use IELTS as a lens to revise your labs, absolutely. So students have to be engaged in authentic practices, right? and experimental design is the ascending practice. But my students never designed anything, so they cannot do it. That's what I hear all the time when we run workshops. My students cannot do it. Your students at Rutgers can do. Mine cannot do it. But when students design the experiments themselves, they are guided, they are helped. So we have questions that help them think, not the questions they help them what to do, but questions that tell them what to think about. And we also have self-assessment rubrics. I'll show you both. Okay, so what questions? Let's go back to this. So remember, when we want them to test their ideas, we actually pose specific questions. We tell them, propose explanations, but do not perform the experiments. So this is kind of a scaffolding questions, a guiding question, that tells them what to think about, but at the same time, it prevents them from going to the equipment and see what happens, you know, let me do this, see what happens. We really teach them systematically to make predictions based on their explanations when they're testing their explanations before they do the experiment. Perform the experiment, record the outcomes, make a judgment about both explanations, right? So they don't look like questions at all. But these are our guiding scaffolds that help our students stay on track with their thinking. But we also have rubrics. So the rubrics are, what are they? They're kind of tables that describe the level of a skill that we want the students to achieve. For example, we want the students to distinguish between a hypothesis and a prediction, right? And it means when they're writing their lab report, if they did not make a prediction about the outcome of the experiment, they get a zero. If the prediction is made but it's identical to the hypothesis, they will get a one. If a prediction is made distinct from the hypothesis but does not clearly describe the outcome, and the outcome means what we will observe, the measurable quantities, not the theoretical thing, it is a two. And if prediction is made, is distinct from the hypothesis, describes the outcome of the experiment, then it's a three. So the students get five or six of this per every lab, and this tells them what they need to worry about. Did I write the prediction? I did. Is it different from the hypothesis? Yes. Did I describe the outcome of the experiment? Oh, no, I was just saying, some general stuff. I better go back and revise and say what should happen in a particular experiment. And we have these rubrics. We have like 40 of them, these little ones, for different abilities. It can be for drawing a force diagram, for how do you compare the results of two experiments. And there's some general guidelines of how to write them. And these guidelines help you as instructors to think of what you want your students to learn. Because how many times do we say we want our students to learn to think critically? Right? Did you tell your students you want them to learn to think critically? Right? Think like a physicist? But did we operationally define it? We operationally defined what it means to think like a physicist, and this information is on the website available, and it's communicated through those rubrics. So whatever aspect of a skill of thinking like a physicist you want them to learn, you can tell them explicitly what it means to think this way and how to practice thinking this way. So what do we know about IELTS students? I could go on for another couple of hours about the research studies that we did studying how they learn to think like physicists. That's exactly what I'm going to do now. They were laughing. Okay. So they do have high gain zone, FCI, CSEM, so all standardized tests that do not measure this thinking, but understanding of some conceptual physics, they do fine. As good reformed courses, they are fine, but they do other things. For example, when they have a multiple choice problem on the exam that asks just for a number, they actually spontaneously, 70 to 80% of them draw a force diagram if it's a dynamics problem on the scrap paper that is given. We collect the scrap papers and we count them. They actually spontaneously draw these diagrams. And they, 80% of them can design their own experiment collect and analyze data the way we want them to, evaluate assumptions, communicate findings, and do other things. And we have years and years of research to back this assertions with the data. So bottom line, if you want the students to learn anything, they will learn it if you know how people learn. The question is, what is it that you want them to learn? And we want them to learn to think like physicists. It's not a very strange thing, right? So we created a ton of resources, and this is our oldest. It's almost 20 years old. It's a video resource where the aisle cycle is described, and there are experiments grouped in these aisle cycles for most of the topics of the course. You can use these experiments, you can use guiding questions, you can read it just to learn more in introduction about the aisle cycle. This is probably the most valuable because this is where the rubrics are, the guiding questions are, all our labs are, not all, some, we need to post more. All materials are free, available, you don't need any password or anything. But this is, you can just Google scientific abilities and this thing comes up. The next one, if you are working with students who have difficulties with math at the college level, or you're teaching high school physics or any kind of introductory physics, this is the place for a lot of curriculum materials. These are curriculum materials. IELTS is not a curriculum, it's a philosophy. We even have an algebra-based textbook called College Physics, very exciting name, but it is fully IELTS-based. For every concept, students start working with observational experiments. They learn how to analyze them, how to come up with explanations, and so on and so forth. Last year, we received an award for the most promising first edition. So people recognize it as a good book. And it comes with the active learning guide and the instructor guide. The active learning guide has all the activities. So we have materials. Before, people would say, yeah, but my textbook does not use this approach. Well, there is a textbook now that does. One of my students, a teacher, designed IELTS-based computer games, and you can't read it very well. It's called www.theuniverseandmore.com. If you're not familiar with this amazing website, I don't know how many people we affected by our teaching. I can probably do a rough estimate, but my student, he's now a teacher, has been a teacher for 6 years, Matt Blackman. I think he's now around 3 million people who played his games. It's amazing. So if you want your students to learn how to analyze graphs and other things, that's the way to go. So, few points to take away. Learning means change. We all know that we change when we teach, right? We learn stuff when we teach it, because this change happens in our bodies. We need to help our students make this change. Brain cycle proceeds from sensory experiences to reasoning to motor functions. It means that students need to have a sensory experience. They need to see something. They need to have an image of something that they need to think about. So imagery building is crucial if you want them to learn. Scientific inquiry engages in processes very similar to how our brain works. So that's why we're so successful, because physics works the way we naturally think. And investigative science learning environment, or IELTS, is the real path that scientists take. I didn't tell you about the study that we have to back it up, but we actually videoed physicists solving a problem, and we analyzed what they were thinking, and they're doing IELTS spontaneously, continuously. And students can participate in real science making if they learn physics through IELTS. And that's the most important part. That if they do this, that we will open to them the best, but so far very hidden part of physics. Thank you very much. Well, I showed you something for you to be challenged, right? If I showed you an experiment for you to invent, what the velocity is, you probably would be bored. But you can use the same path to help students construct any idea because they come with a lot of knowledge already about the world. They've been living in the physical world for 20 years or 18, whatever, right? They have tons of ideas. We just need to harness and channel them productively. We say that students are full of cognitive resources. So if we know these resources, we can build on them. And when you were creating these explanations, right, you see they were analogical. You see, maybe it's like this. Maybe it's like a thin film. Maybe it's like that. So they also can create these analogies based on the experiences that they have. And that's exactly the essence of the process. So is there some basic knowledge they need to have? We show that no. And actually, if you watch a three-year-old, you will see him or her doing this process naturally. Let me answer this, and then we'll come back to... Totally true. Of course, they don't have any experience with, quantum mechanical properties of elementary particles, yet we have studies coming out of students' misconceptions in quantum mechanics. So what is similar to the process is that you help them start learning quantum mechanics based on experimentation, the way it was actually done, not by writing equations. So you need to start thinking, what were the experiments that led people to thinking this way, right? They don't necessarily need to do these experiments because by the time they get to quantum mechanics, if they learn this way, and even if they didn't, they already can understand what experiments are, how you collect data, and all these other things. So you can present them with the data in forms of tables, in forms of photographs, or some other sources. For example, if you do research in X-ray astrophysics, you never do any experiments. You just get tables of data and you analyze them, right? So data is a very broad term, right? What kind of data they will get. But the point is, they can get the data, and then they can reason about this data with prompts and scaffolding, of course. But if you give them the right data, they will arrive to good hypothesis. Testing is different again. You know, astronomers don't do any experiments, right? How do they test? They find data that already exists. To find this data, they need to actually predict its existence. So they can say, we could do this experiment or that experiment. You say, yeah, that's exactly the experiment Stern and Gerlach did, right? And that's what they got. So here, knowing the history is really crucial, but not impossible. Yes.
So you talked about how the fact that
I think there is a fundamental difference, and biology is that you can almost never do an experiment in class because it takes, 5 years or 10 years to grow a tree, right? So you rely more on the experiments that others did, right? So that's one thing. Another thing is that biosystems are inherently much more complex, right? So making predictions is much more difficult, and there's certain, you know, parts of biology where you can make predictions, but if you take ecology, then it's very complicated. However, you know, my son is a professor at San Jose State University. He teaches biology, and he uses this method. In the corner of his classroom, he has a magic box. This is the experiment box. So the students suggest what experiments to do. He goes there, he cranks something, and he says, well, this is the experiment made in 1956, right? And he presents the results. So we can go around these obstacles. If the students feel like, oh, I just designed the experiment, then, you know, Watson and Crick design. And you tell them. You know, our students discover photoelectric effect in the lab, right? We give them the equipment, and they come up with certain patterns and say, well, that's exactly what people discovered and called the photoelectric effect. They have an electroscope, and they discharge it with UV light and not discharge it with regular visible light. So it is possible in other sciences, but you really, you know, people ask me, like, how do you design these materials? And I'd say there are two things that you need to do. First, you really need to know the history of your science very, very well, because people think that, let's say, quantum mechanics is purely theoretical. Max Born addressed this issue many years ago when he said, well, it's very experimental. All physics is based, starts with an experiment. Is that after a while, we forget where we started. And so you need to go back as a teacher to find, how did people figure it out? And then what can I do to help my students do it? Not in a similar way, in a different way, by having this knowledge. And second, when students come up with ideas, you remember them and you're ready for next time. You know what ideas they come up with. And the first time you do it is difficult. The second time is difficult. The third time is difficult. After 15 years, you're fine. Well, it doesn't take 15 years, but it takes good 5 years to know what people are thinking. And then when in the workshop, we did a real experiment and people came up with different ideas and we had the equipment to test all of them. We were prepared because we did it before. So listening to your students helps tremendously, and seeing them as sources of good ideas, not wrong ideas, is very, very helpful. Now you can ask your question. Huh. Yeah, statistics. Hey, you're talking about error analysis. Yeah. Well, that's a good question. This is the third time I hear this question today, so it's a very painful question, right? Well, you know, I'll tell you the truth. The way I see it, is that our traditional approach to error analysis is not very productive because students get bogged down in calculations, and when they get a number, they have no idea what this number means, right? It becomes mechanical, the same way we're using math procedurally in physics, not thinking about the operations, right? Like, you know, for example, multiplication in mathematics is you multiply and something by a certain number, it means you're adding this three times if you multiply by three. Well, when you do mass momentum as mass times velocity, you're not doing the same operation, right? You're not adding three velocities together if the mass is 3 kilograms, right? So the same way students treat math procedurally in physics, they treat error analysis procedurally in the lab. So we solve this problem in two ways. First, we remove the word error. We call it uncertainty, experimental uncertainty, and we removed systematic error from the concepts of uncertainty at all. We put systematic error in the assumptions. And you have to validate assumptions. Now, if we talk about experimental uncertainty, we broke it down into two parts, instrumental uncertainty and random uncertainty. And then we said, okay, we are going to worry about what gives us the biggest uncertainty. Do we have an instrument that gives us the biggest uncertainty, or our random uncertainty beats all instrumental uncertainty? I don't care about the propagation. If some instrument gives me 10% uncertainty in its measurement, then it will be 10%. Well, is it 9.2 or 10.3? I don't really care, right? I just know whatever I get is within 10%. If my random, I repeat the experiment, like dropping something and pushing the button, and my reaction time is 0.3 seconds, yours probably 0.2, but still, that will determine everything as percent uncertainty. So we use what's called the weakest link rule. We determine what gives you the biggest percent uncertainty about, and that's what everything we get at the end, we know that much, right? So if we found that something gives us 10% uncertainty and we find the final result, like the coefficient of friction is 0.3, it's 0.3 plus minus 10%. And we don't worry about the minutia. We do it with algebra-based courses for science majors. We do it in the courses for engineers, and they finally understand what uncertainty is. And because we want them to understand that any number that is written in their book is not a number, it's an interval. If they can see any number in physics as an interval, we reached our goal. And if they go later in advanced courses and do some advanced statistics, you know, let them do it. But they will do it with the understanding of this, what this statistic actually does, as opposed to just going through the motions. And that's what I did when I was a student. I could calculate the uncertainty, I had no idea what it meant.
One more question, maybe, or we could also just come down. Yes, she'll be around, so please come down and ask her to help us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.